Hey everyone, and welcome to Developer Tea. My name is Jonathan Cottrell, and today is the second part of my interview with Cap Watkins. If you missed the first part, make sure you jump back and listen to it before you listen to the second part. As I mentioned on the first episode, Cap is the VP of Design at BuzzFeed, and we talk all about different things related to collaboration between designers and developers. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed interviewing Cap. As always, all of the relevant links will be in the show notes, which you can find at spec.fm. I hope you enjoy the second part of my interview with Cap Watkins. There is something to be said for, like, how do we talk to each other, right? Like, we have to have some kind of shared vocabulary and allow people to be experts in what they're experts at. But how do we, you know, how can we get to the place where we're doing all of those things with relatively small teams? I think that's the big problem, right, is the size of the team. Because when you have a marketing channel for, you know, a massive company has people who are dedicated to, you know, figuring out how to get conversion rates based on advertising, and they have it down to a science, you know. And that may be true for even teams of BuzzFeed size. There are a lot of teams, like the team I'm on, we have a guy who is doing some marketing work and marketing research and, you know, compiling analytics and trying to gain insights from it. But, you know, teams of that size, we all have to be aware of the things that marketing is aware of.
Yeah, totally. I actually feel bad that we lose that as we get bigger. I think that's sad. I mean, I don't think there's an easy answer to that, but I think as companies get bigger, what I've witnessed is, like, more specialization and more, again, like, it's not so much siloing. No one's trying to keep people out. It's just, it becomes impractical. Like, it becomes impractical to try to, like, communicate all of that stuff to everyone. I mean, when a company gets a certain size, like, the entire company isn't moving together. It's actually not like that anymore. It's like, you know, we break it down.
Individual teams.
Right. And so now you have marketing broken down into smaller teams alongside product broken down into smaller teams, design, engineering, whatever. And maybe those things can stay in sync. I guess that's what I am trying to push on, like, with the product designers and, like, also coding and, like, feel like trying to broaden instead of narrow. Because I get a lot of comments about, like, well, when are you just going to have visual designers? And when are you just going to have UX designers? And I'm like, hopefully never. You know, I really hope that, like, we can become more general, you know, and like, just push this generalist thing even as we get bigger. We'll stay tuned on how that works out for us.
Yeah, and I think people demonize the word general a little bit too much.
Oh, sure.
Because that word assumes that you aren't becoming an expert at something, right? Like, it assumes that to be general, you can't be a specialist at the same time.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's true.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the people that say that are the specialists. I mean, I really do.
The ones who decided not to be generalists?
I think so. I mean, the people that I talk to, they're like, well, you know, a designer who's a generalist isn't as good a visual designer as a visual designer. And I'm like, well, that's actually not my experience. You know, like, actually the best designers, visual and otherwise, that I've met are, like, general product designers. And, like, everybody has different things they're really great at and things they're not as great at, right? I mean, like, I feel like I'm pretty strong, like, front end person and, like, pretty strong UX person. Visual design, I'm okay. Like, I'm okay. Not great. And that's okay, right? Like, the nice thing about generalists is, like, they fit together in similar ways to if you did hire a bunch of specialists. So, like, I'm best paired with someone who is very strong visual designer and, you know, also strong at one of the other things too, right? Like, we, like, it's still extremely possible to be extremely good at things. I think you have more opportunity to be good, extremely good at more things if you're doing more things. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, it's kind of a broad net kind of thing. And I think the people who argue against the generalist concept is, or their thinking, or maybe their part of their theory is that, you know, these things don't overlap, right? Or they don't feed each other. Like, to be a good developer, you know, to be the best developer, I need some kind of sense of design. I need some kind of sense of visual design, right? I need some kind of sense of user experience. And I don't think I can be a specialist developer without those things.
Yeah, I mean, I've even seen at Amazon, I was technically considered a UX designer. And we had a visual design team, which was separate from us. And I mean, we sat together, but it was a different thing. And I would actually get kind of pushed back on if I delivered anything that remotely resembled something polished.
Like, why was,
well, that was just, so this was the way it was, whatever, right? So whatever, that this is the way they've chosen to build their organization. I was, you know, I had no control over that, so I let it go.
Sure. Yeah.
But the hard part was when I would hand over my wireframes, that, like, with a lot of UX stuff in it, with a lot of flows in it, with a lot of, like, very specific, I mean, even like touch target sizes, I needed to be pretty explicit. So you wind up seeing these visual designs that, like, just like had nothing, like would just drop things like touch target sizing and just drop out things like type size, like legible type size. And you're just going like, what happened? You know? And it's not that they're bad visual designers, right? It's actually not true. What's true is, like, they have no idea, because they weren't a part of the UX process and they didn't come up with the UX alongside us, that, like, they have no idea why we made the decisions we made or what decisions are important. And when you are, like, throwing stuff over a wall or handing it off to someone else to take the next specialist step with it, like, there's always, you're always going to lose stuff in that translation, always. And it's going to be super painful, and you're going to spend a lot of time trying to explain it, and you may never get there. And you're going to wind up with something that's, like, not as good as it could be, because neither of you, and you don't understand why they're making the decisions they're making either. Right, that's the thing, and it goes both ways. So, like, that person would make those decisions, and we would talk about them, and I would have no, I could not unpack, like, why those decisions got made. He was like, this, he'd be like, oh, well, it just looks really cool, and it's like, great, like, great, it's illegible, you know. It's like, and we have this thing going back and forth, and, like, it would have been much easier if we'd been working on the exact same thing at the same time, and gone through the UX together, gone through the visual design of it together, and, like, come out the other side. And even if one of us was stronger at one than the other, like, maybe I take on, like, more of the heavy UX work because I'm better at that, but this person still contributes to the UX work, right? So at the end of the day, they're bought in, first of all, and they don't try to change it. And, like, then, this, you know what I mean? Because they've been a part of the process. Yeah. And then, like, then I'm more satisfied with, like, I'll, no matter what, be more satisfied with the visual design because, like, this person will have taken into consideration everything that we've done so far because he's done it with us. And so this sort of collaboration stuff, and this same thing with developers too, is, like, and that's why we push transparency and collaboration, designers and code, developers and design, because, like, at the end of the day, if everybody's bought in before you start building or designing a single thing, everything is better. And everybody's much, much happier, and the product is, like, incredible, like, just, like, heads and tails better than it would have been.
Yeah, I mean, people are not good at actually having good inputs into other processes, right? So, like, what you said, I think, is right on point, that when you try to transfer that stuff over to somebody else, there's going to be a lot that is missed, right? Or maybe even totally ignored, which is what you were saying about, like, the illegibility. It's not enough to do, you know, A through C and then expect somebody to know where to pick up. Sure. And because basically what we have to do, and this especially falls on developers a lot of the time, because, you know, the typical process is, you know, in a lot of agencies, you know, we do, like, a discovery thing where we figure out what it is that we're going to build, and then we design it, and then we execute the build, right? And that's, there are, you can make that work. It's possible to make that work. The issues that arise happen when you go from discovery to design, and then from design to development. There's a lot of lossy, you know, like you're saying, translation between the two, because it's like, well, you didn't think about the 404 page. Or you didn't think about this particular viewport size, or, you know, whatever. And eventually you end up collaborating, right? Either you end up collaborating, or the developer does the designer's job, or the designer does the discovery person's job, whatever you want to call that person, content team. You know, that creates this situation where you have a little bit of animosity, because it's like, you handed me something that I can't do, right? Mm-hmm. Or you handed me something that isn't all the way thought out, and it doesn't become all the way thought out until launch.
Right.
And I think it's better for that to happen from the start, right? Like, which is what you're saying, is transparency from the beginning, having people involved from the beginning. That is, you know, the thinking out process starts at the beginning, and you start answering those questions about legibility at the very beginning of the process.
Yeah, and I think it also helps, this is a really interesting thing, but I think it helps with retention. I think if you're happy at the end of a thing you did, you know, like, if you believe,
right, rather than resentful,
right? If you believe in the thing you just shipped, or you just had to build, or you just designed, you know, I mean, like, that's huge. Like, that's so huge. I honestly think developers get the worst of this, because it is like they do get kind of thought of as like resources, and design gets thrown over the wall at them, and that's like a huge bummer. And I feel like, mm-hmm. I can't imagine what that's like. I mean, it sounds awful.
I can tell you.
It sounds really bad. I mean, I hope to have never done that so much in my career. I'm sure I've done it at times, and I apologize if you're out there listening. That must be so crummy, you know? And then at the end, even if you did push back as a developer, even if you did like somehow get some of the changes that you thought were important, like, you still don't feel good. You know, I mean, and neither does the person you just argued with, you know, over the thing that they thought was complete, right? And so, like, I don't know. The more the people, again, we keep talking about this, like, smashing these things together, like, getting them closer, like, getting them earlier, getting together earlier, just feels like it's so easy to do, and it actually reduces the time it takes to do things, and it leaves everybody, like, kind of pumped at the end, which is never a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing wrong with somebody having, you know, creative control for periods of that time, right? Like, sometimes, you know, call it a cave or whatever, but you need to go into your space and not be bothered for whatever, a couple hours to iterate through something. You don't need somebody standing over your shoulder all the time. So I think there's a balance that has to be struck.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely more collaboration from where the industry in large, I guess, currently is, would be better.
Yeah, absolutely.
So switching gears entirely to this hiring conversation, because there's so many people who listen to this show, and there's actually a lot of you who would be considered a designer at BuzzFeed right now. And Cap talks about this on Design Details, and also I think in a couple of blog posts, but the designers that Cap hires are the typical unicorn. How much do you cringe when you hear it, Cap?
I'm not calling myself that, so I don't care what we call them. I'm just kidding. It doesn't bother me. I think it's dumb. But it's not a
it's whatever. It's a designer who can do CSS and HTML, right?
Yeah, totally. And also, just for what it's worth, there are worse words you could call somebody than a unicorn, I think. I mean, you know,
that's true.
We can cringe all we want, but it's kind of nice. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess so. So we'll stick with it. Unicorn. Why not?
Yeah, sure.
Let's just be shameless. Unicorn.
YOLO, as we would say at BuzzFeed.
Hey, why not? That is the kind of, you know, designer that BuzzFeed is hiring. So if you are a front-end developer and you're looking for jobs, don't close yourself off to the possibility of being fit for a designer position. You may not see yourself that way, but that very well could be a great fit for you without you even realizing it, right?
Totally.
So tell me what you at BuzzFeed are looking for in that position, the young designer, the junior position.
Sure.
And maybe it's not young, but
yeah, just go junior. Ahead. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I mentioned resilience earlier. I feel like it's a really big deal. A lot comes down to that. I think, especially when you're like earlier in your career, mm-hmm. I'll avoid the word younger as well. In your career, or been working alone for a long time. Like, I did that for a long time, and I thought it's really funny. I worked at startups for the first 5 years of my career or so, and I really thought that I was senior. Like, after all that experience, I felt like I really got it. And then I went to Amazon and realized I was so not. Started to work with other designers for the first time, and you're just going like, oh my God. These people are so smart and like have so much process that I'd never developed because I had been working alone. So I think like for, you know, folks that are kind of starting out in design and stuff, what we're looking for is, yeah, resilience is really important. Being able to kind of like, you know, push forward through things you don't know, push forward through things that aren't going so well because you don't know how to do them yet. Or because, you know, you do them poorly. That has to be there. Curiosity is a huge deal. I was talking to a designer the other day, and I was asking I was asking her, like, you know, well, how do you, she works alone. I was like, well, how do you, like, get better at stuff? Like, how do you, you know, what are you doing to, like, learn what you don't know? And she's like, she started, like, just listing all these, like, blogs she follows and all these books she's read. That's awesome, right? It's like this drive and momentum that, like, even if she doesn't work at BuzzFeed, or even if she, you know, even if she doesn't work anywhere with more designers, like, she's gonna, like, she is pushing, going to push herself into that place because she's curious and she wants to know more and she knows what she doesn't know. That feels really important.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about the resilience. How do you actually, like, as a, you know, prospective designer, I guess, as a young designer, I keep on using the term.
That's fine.
As a beginner designer, how would I go about, you know, expressing resilience? How can you evaluate that, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, I ask a lot of questions that are, that require examples. So,
like, give an example of when you're resilient.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't ask like that, right? It would be, give me an example of a time that you disagreed with your product manager and, like, strongly disagreed, and then what happened, right? Like, and then they tell the story, because everybody's got that story, everyone, right? And they get to the end of it, and they're like, yeah, and so, you know, we really disagreed, and I thought it should be this way, and they thought it should be this way, and we wound up doing this thing. And I was like, well, okay, cool. So, like, talk more about how you got there, right? Like, what happened? Like, what was the conversation like? Like, you know what I mean? Like, how many times did you go back and forth? Like, did you feel okay? Did you feel good about the result? If so, great. If not, why not? And so it's just like, it's like peeling the onion a little bit on people. Other thing we do is, when we do bring people in for an interview in the office, we do, as part of that, some design whiteboarding. And typically what I try to do is, you know, you give people something, you know, vague enough so they can kind of, like, start to play around with it, and then begin to add constraints or more things to do, like, as it's happening. So to see how people are able to pivot and think, you know, so it's like, all right, so we've done this now. What would happen if we learned, like, what would you do if we, like, did this or did some research and we learned this thing? Right. That, like,
sure. Like, it has to work on a screen reader.
Sure. Right. Right. Or, like, it contradicts, or what we've learned has contradicted what you've done here. Right. So, like, what would happen? Right. Or, you know, hey, we just got a call from the, you know, people that we're doing this with, and they actually said that they messed up and that these are the new constraints. Right. Like, no one really ever, like, crumbles at this point. Right. But the ability to kind of, like, really easily pivot on that and just be like, okay, great. Like, you know what I mean? Like, sure. Okay, fine.
It's just another iteration at that point.
Right. Because, you know, you're looking in that first question, and even in the whiteboarding thing, like, we're looking for folks who can, like, because there are going to be disagreements, right? There are going to be hard conversations with your team and other teams. I want folks on the team that can manage and navigate those conversations more than I think I want folks who are, like, extremely polished designers.
Rock stars.
I think like, I could teach someone HTML and CSS, right? Like, if we paired somebody with a really strong UX designer, they could learn UX design. And if they have some taste, like, which is usually pretty apparent from the portfolio at all, like, they're going to get better at visual design. Like, those things are all, like, either teachable or pretty apparent. I think the hardest thing in hiring is really finding folks, even junior people, who are able to, like, easily navigate conversations, know what they don't know, admit what they don't know, and then, like, in the face of adversity, you know, continue just to, like, go.
Like, what happens under the stress?
Yeah, because it is stressful. It's like, it can be really stressful sometimes. Those two things that I ask those people are the same, are the true for every level. Hire for
it's and that was going to be my next question is, like, once somebody is a junior designer, because there's plenty of those listening to the show too, how can they feasibly, you know, develop the skills necessary to go from junior to, say, a managing designer?
I mean a lot of it's experience, obviously.
The number of years.
It's not number. It's more like, what are the experiences you've had and how have you handled those experiences? I mean, at that point, if you're at BuzzFeed, we've had firsthand knowledge of that. You know, like, I mean, the entire time. Start to, like, identify strengths and weaknesses, starting, you know, to help people, you know, maximize their strengths and kind of, like, put them in positions where their weaknesses don't matter so much. You know, if you're not great at front-end development, like, you're going to, actually working at BuzzFeed, you're going to get better. Right? I mean, like, it's just, like, it's just how it's going to be, right? Because there's no escaping that we're going to be doing that. So, you know, as long as you come in ready to go, like, and learn some stuff, we're going to do it. You know, if you're, like, not strong at UX. Like, we're probably going to throw some stuff at you that's UX stuff, and we're going to pair you with people who are good at that, and you're going to learn some things. I mean, like, typically my experience is, like, no one stays in the junior role more than, like, a year and a half maybe, because that role is actually mostly about hard skills, and we can, I mean, if we're not teaching you that fast enough, that's a problem for us, not for the person.
So it's a learning position, basically, like a second level internship almost.
I mean, yeah, kind of. And then, like, the product design level is, like, once we get into, like, that kind of, like, mid-level thing, it starts to become more about, you know, like, a really, like, articulated process that you can repeat and get good results out of, right? And then, like, from senior and up, you start to see more of, like, soft skills emerge, where even for non-managers, like, becoming a leader on the team and being able to mentor other designers and make other people around you better just because you're there, you know, is extremely important. And some of those folks are so good at that and they like it so much, they become managers, right? And then other folks, like, really don't want to have one-on-ones and deal with, you know, balance sheets.
Personal issues. And
or even just, like, the you know, stupid stuff like budgets. And, like some people just don't care about that, but they really enjoy, like, helping designers do better work, and they really enjoy doing the work. And, like, that's great, and we're going to provide that path. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how it happens. It moves from, like, hard skills to kind of, like, some hard and soft stuff around, like, process articulation, and then basically more and more into soft skills as you, like, become better at what you're doing.
And eventually you aren't designing at all if you're the VP.
Yeah, if that sounds great, then, yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, you know, climb on up,
right,
you know?
Right, exactly.
That's great. Yeah. By the way, I really enjoyed the lie that you tell new hires. I'm not going to ruin the surprise for anyone who's listening, because I think, first of all, time constraints at this point, but go and read it. I'm going to put it in the show notes. It's really one of the better, kind of, especially for managers who are listening to this. And if you are cultivating a team and you're trying to cultivate, you know, new practices, especially on your team, that's a really good read. I thought that was clever and really good.
Thanks.
Good insight.
Thanks.
So another shift in terms of topic here. How much of the CSS architecture are you personally actually responsible for, you know, that actually gets shipped to the front end of BuzzFeed?
In March of this year, I started to kind of play around with writing a CSS framework for BuzzFeed.
It didn't have one at all before that?
Not comprehensive. Okay. There was a lot of old code on the site. There were a couple front end developers, like, trying to refactor every single page. It's just like there was no framework to build that on top of.
Mm-hmm.
I started to play around with it on a train one day, pinged one of the other designers, a senior designer at BuzzFeed, who's actually, like, one of the strongest front ends we have. And she and I started to kind of, like, toss this code back and forth in a GitHub repo, started adding to it, you know, trying to figure out what we would need, what we wouldn't need. Kind of the approach we wanted to take, and started to pull in more people as we started to realize this might be really useful and powerful. And so by a couple months in, we had, I want to say, two or three more designers contributing to it, and we had a regular meeting every week about it to check in on it and, like, assign cards and stuff and starting to, like, actually make it a project. And then a couple front-end developers that were helping kind of, they were kind of advising on the project, because these were the people that were, like, actually trying to, like, refactor every template, and so they were obviously extremely interested in what we were doing. That was in March. At this point, we've, like, released 1.0 internally. It's being used in a ton of internal projects. Like, almost every internal project now is, like, on this framework. We're technically at 1.0.5 right now, and we're developing 1.6.
Nice.
Yeah, it feels good. And, like, this week we're going into production with it. Just the CSS, like, to make it available so people working on projects on the web app can use it. Like, the entire web app won't be, like, converted over or anything, but, like, it won't look any different.
From what you said, it's really light, right? Like, you said it was 8K.
Yeah, it's 8 kilobytes gzipped. So basically what we've done is, like, if you're familiar with, like, Brent Jackson and Base CSS, we took almost that exact concept. Actually, I hired Brent at Etsy.
Very
which
nice.
Which is funny, which is actually how I know about this at all. But we took all those concepts and kind of, like, did our version of that. And the idea is, it's like atomic CSS. So essentially we rewrote all of CSS as class names. So float left, you know, is a class name, and display block is a class name. What you wind up with is not a lot of CSS, but you can basically in HTML build and style anything, which is pretty rad. yeah, we've been building that for the last, what are we now, like, is that like 5 months, 4 months? I have probably contributed at this point 50% or so of the code.
Wow. Code, yeah.
And code deletions. Like, I looked at my stats the other day and I've deleted twice as much code as I've added. I feel pretty good about that.
That's the mark of a great developer. The best code you write is the negative lines that you put into your GitHub repo.
Yeah. So I like, and actually I spent the last couple of weeks, we're starting to gear up to like put the documentation online and put the CSS online for people. I'm not sure if we're going to open source it or not, something we've talked about, but there's a lot like of course like responsibility there. So we're trying to figure out how we're going to handle that if we're going to do it. But in lieu of like the documentation going online, like I was like, okay, well, it's been cool internally because we all knew what we meant.
Like, yeah,
someone
yeah.
should rewrite this. And so so I started to kind of go, I've gone through every single page and completely rewritten it from scratch, which was hilarious because I uncovered a bunch of bugs in the CSS as a result of rewriting the documentation.
In the process.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Which is pretty magical. So go out and rewrite your documentation. You'll find a lot of stuff. So that's done. And now we're just kind of doing some last minute stuff. I'm like doing some cleanup on like our navigation system for the documentation and stuff.
Do you guys use like a pre-processed language?
Yeah, so
internally,
we're using
or?
SAS.
Okay. SAS or SCSS?
We're using SCSS files, but I think the syntax is SAS, I'm pretty sure.
So is it, well, so it's either the bracketed one or the one with the indents. Does it look like regular CSS sort of?
It can. I mean, we're writing like functions and mixins, obviously, and like.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Fewer and fewer people are writing the SAS proper. In fact, there's a lot of people that don't even use it at all or don't even know about it. It's a totally different syntax and it's not interoperable with regular CSS. So you can't drop, you know, your CSS blocks into SAS and expect it to work because white space is actually regarded in SAS.
Yeah. I've always been confused about that because like our front end developers, I've had this exact argument before or this discussion before. Mm-hmm. And I go back to BuzzFeed and I'm like, you guys, we're using SAS, right? And they're like, yes, but we're actually, those files still have CSS in them and they're still SCSS files. So I'm not really sure what like the distinction is because like we're definitely using SAS syntax.
Yeah. Well, and they have basically it's the processor is the same, right? So the output would be the same. It's just the input, right? So like the at syntax and all those mixins and stuff that you use, that's the same stuff as SAS proper or whatever.
Sure.
But you just add the brackets so that white space is not the deal, you know. And you can also you put back in the semicolons and colons. So that's the way you're separating your stuff. And in SAS, like the white space version, it's not that way.
Right. Got it.
It's kind of weird. I don't like SAS actually personally, the SAS proper.
Sure.
I love SCSS now.
I feel like that's the only way to go. I don't really understand how you would ever,
why you would ever do the other.
Like, yeah. I just feel like that's a really great way to learn something that is not a standard.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's one of the things that I respect about CoffeeScript, by the way. I don't know if you're familiar, but you can write regular JavaScript in a CoffeeScript file and it will work. So you can move like one piece at a time over and change the syntax to the more CoffeeScript-esque version of it, right? And the same thing is true for SCSS or, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. So
SAS
something. Yes. So yeah, we're using that. I mean, like we're using it, I feel like, responsibly. I know people have mixed feelings about this stuff. The way I think we've approached it, I don't know if anybody's ever articulated this. They may all think I'm crazy. But like the way I think we've approached it is more of like a way of just not repeating ourselves. We only, you know what I mean? We only would make a function or a mixin when we know what the output is already because we've written it. And it's just like, okay, well, this will be a pain if we ever want to change it because we might. So let's like wrap this in a mixin because we know exactly how much CSS it is because we've already written it. You know what I mean? It's like we're not writing it blind. We're writing it like basically after we write the vanilla CSS version most times and then realize that we can like kind of like wrap it up a little bit nicer for ourselves.
Yeah, make it look a little better.
Yeah, and also just like there have been so many. I mean, there have been a couple times actually where we've wanted to change like a spacing variable and want it to change everywhere, right, in the CSS. And so being able to change that in one single place is like so nice, and not trying to search for the value because mm-hmm. that value, because we're all, it's all in REMs, and so like that value could be on things that are not spaces, you know, that are not spacing things, and so
you have to look at every single one,
right, as opposed to being like, oh, this space variable, which we know we haven't used on anything that's not a spacing thing, like, is we could just change it and it'll be fine. And then there are times where we don't use any variables to declare the exact same value because the value is not the thing that's important, right? The value isn't the important thing. It's actually like the context it's in. And so we're using it that way. And I feel like that's been actually really successful for us. And like, again, like hasn't led to a ton of code bloat or anything, which I feel pretty good about.
Yeah, definitely.
So anyway, yeah. So like it's, I've written about 50%. I think like we've had 5 designers contribute to it. And I mean, I mean like 98% of it's been written by designers at this point. Wow. Which is pretty rad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool. I don't think anybody saw that coming.
So go in and give all of your designers a little badge. Find like a sticker or something that says, congratulations, you're now a front-end developer.
Yeah, it's been pretty interesting, actually. So there was that one designer, like I said, who was like pretty proficient already. And then there was another designer who, I might be wrong about this, but I don't think she had ever written a line of CSS. Like maybe she'd done a little bit, but she had never like done it in production, never like done it to prototype, nothing. She basically was coming from like essentially zero. And she has like turned into the biggest contributor to this thing. Like she is such like, she's so deep in it. She knows how to write CSS really well now. She's like teaching other people like how to do this stuff. She's having opinions on how to write like, you know, on code, like pull requests and stuff. It's been really magical to see that happen with folks who have worked on this project, like who maybe didn't have that background, and then like through the project basically learned how to do it and became huge advocates for it. And now she's like, there are times she's completely skipping even going into Sketch or Photoshop so she can like, because she's going to prototype with this framework that she helped build.
Sure.
You know, and it's like, it's really, I walked over to her desk the other day and I was like, wait, what is this? What are you doing? And she's like, oh, I'm writing this prototype, whatever. And I was like, oh my God. Cause like, it's like never happened before. You know, it's like, it's so, so cool.
It's really interesting. Cause that stuff can translate. You can hand that off to a developer.
I mean, especially with the framework, right? Because what's really cool is like, if we prototype it, even not in the actual code base, although sometimes we're doing that, like, because this framework is class-based, like, and because the framework is already in the web app, all that has to happen essentially is the developer, like, we give them the front end, the HTML, and they can like literally copy and paste it, and it will just look correct, and they don't have to deal with any CSS. There's no garbage like at all, and so it's actually pretty powerful. The developers I've talked to who've used it so far are so grateful to not have to do that part anymore. They're all, like, I've been told that a couple of times. They're like, I really am so glad I get to do the fun part of my job, which is like wire this thing up, like make it work
to an API and do the models.
Yeah, they get to do
stuff.
All the fun stuff that they like to do. And they're like, you know, I really always dreaded the CSS. Like I didn't want to, it's not that I wasn't good at it, I just didn't want to do it. Like I didn't, they
right. Yeah.
I totally,
implementation
get that.
Details for them.
Super get that, right? I don't want to be responsible for writing, you know, backend architecture. So, you know, we're even, we're square. Like, you know what I mean? And so it's been pretty, pretty, pretty cool to see that happen.
Well, that's interesting you bring up the backend architecture thing, because I was going to say, we actually have experimented with this at the company that I work for. And we have designers that will jump in and, you know, build out a WordPress project or something. And every once in a while, we realize, oh, wait a second, like we've thrown too much at this particular person.
That's,
you know,
good.
Like they can go up to a certain point and then it's like full on stop, you know, and there's no progress after that point, because, you know, that's totally out of their wheelhouse. They were never, you know, we didn't even intend for them to have to do those things, but the project requirements had shifted enough, and we didn't plan for the development team to be holding on to that project at the time.
Totally.
It's a very interesting problem to try to solve.
I'd rather be solving that. You know what I mean? Like I'd rather solve those kinds of problems. Like I'd rather hit a full stop because we tried too much. You know, because like we let people extend beyond themselves and try things they've never tried before. You know what I mean? This just feels like such a much better problem than like, oh, well, this person's frustrated because they can't try things. You know, it's like...
Yeah, yeah. Sending 20 emails back and forth trying to figure out who's right.
Yeah, I mean, like, actually, so the residency thing, we have a someone on our product support team who wants to do a residency with the ops team. And I heard that today and I was like, I don't even know what that means. Like, what does that mean? And like, they talked to the ops team and the folks on the team were like, yeah, no, totally. We'll like, we'll each of us will peel off this much time each day, and like, we'll help this person do whatever they're going to do. It's kind of crazy. Like, it's kind of awesome. Like, that, like, where does that happen? Who does that?
You
know,
sure.
Like, you know what I mean? I like
people again who feel safe in failing.
Right. Well, and then you have like, it's not even just that. You, like, if we just put this person on that team with zero support, like, you could say that. You could say, like, yeah, sure, totally. You can do this team for 6 weeks. And then, like, if the team wasn't, like, generous, right, with their time and their expertise, like, it would be a huge failure, and that person would probably still be really frustrated.
And that comes back to hiring. Oh, hiring totally people does. who are going to be doing that properly, yeah.
Like, how can you just, like, increase the generosity of your team? Yeah. You know, it's a really hard problem. Yeah. It's very, like, it's a very person-to-person thing.
Yeah. Like, do you ask that question up front and be like, hey, so are you a generous...
That's a tough one. And it's more cultural, I think, than anything else. Like, it's like, even if you come from a place where it wasn't like that, it is extremely possible to, you know, to create a culture where it's just an infectious thing. You're right. It's like, it's just like, oh, wow, that happened. Like, it happened. You're watching it happen to other people. And if we all celebrate that publicly, that it's happening and how amazing,
and you'll
that,
do it too.
You know what I mean? You'll be like, whoa, that is really cool. Right? Like, I mean, like... Unless you have zero heart whatsoever, it's really cool. Like,
well, we tend to follow the things that our friends do, right? Like, there was a stat that came out recently that said if you have a much higher, it's some crazy number percentage chance of being obese if your best friends are obese, right? Like, and the flip flop is true. If your best friends are fit, then you have a much higher chance of being, you know, fit. And that's a weird, like, reality for the workplace. Is if you act in certain ways at work, especially if you're in a position of leadership, oh, right? Yeah. Like, if I am being generous with my teammates and we show appreciation to the people who are leading or who are managing or whatever, then they will in turn show appreciation to those around them very often.
Yeah, I also think I always feel bad when we talk about that as like a leadership thing, I think, because like, I think what happens is people think
it's a tactic or something.
Well, no, I think like it's, I think it can be discouraging to folks who are not in a management position. I think like, it's like, oh, well, I'm not in a management position. I'm on this team in a company that doesn't quite have that culture. I mean, there's people listening right now who are thinking this, right? And they're like, oh, and there's nothing I can do about it because like they're saying like, of course, like Cap's the VP of design. Like, of course he can like do whatever he wants, right? Like, of course he can make that however he wants it to be, right? But like the trick is, I think, like leadership, it's not like a role. There's no title, right, that says like, sure, leadership, mm-hmm, on it. Forget the whole culture of the whole organization. Forget that, right? Like, if you're on a team of five people, it doesn't matter if you're a junior designer. It doesn't matter if you're a mid-level engineer or like new or whatever. You can impact that change locally. You know, it can definitely happen from a bottom up, in a bottom up way. Right.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I hate the term bottom. It drives me crazy. But like, but like that's how these folks feel. Right. They feel like they're at the bottom. It can definitely happen at a local level. There are some teams that I've seen, like companies I've worked at or whatever, they're just functioning better. You know, mm-hmm, it's just like five people that just together are just like crushing it and doing so much good work. And everyone around them is just like, how the hell is that happening? The fact is that like the culture in total obviously isn't that. Whatever that team is doing, right? Because that's why everybody's asking themselves, like, what the hell is this? But, like, because that happened locally, it's actually starting to impact the teams around them because they're all asking themselves, like, and each other, like, how is this possible? Like, what's, like, they seem so happy. They seem to be pushing code so fast. Like, the work they're doing is so great. Like, what is happening? Is it a bunch of senior people? No. Right? Is it, like, what is happening in that team that makes it so successful? Then you will start to have emulation, right? You'll start to have questions being asked. And like, these are good things that can impact, it can wind up actually impacting the entire culture.
Yeah, that's so true.
So I think it's hard because like when you're in that position, you're like, well, I'm in this position and I need to change the whole culture and I can't do that. But like, you don't actually have to do that, right? You can like really just focus on your relationships, right? Like, how can you make the engineers feel really good and like collaborative and like brought into the process as an engineer? How can you like teach the designer stuff they don't know about how the code works? Like, if you're a product person, how can you include everybody in the product road mapping process on your team? And then like, that's enough. Do you know, like, that's enough to really like,
yeah, because it has a cascading effect throughout the rest of the people that they interact
with.
Well,
and even if it doesn't, like, at least you're on a team that's awesome, you know, like,
sure,
you know, you wind up,
you affected your work.
Yeah, you wind up in a place that like is better for you anyway. And like, and then if coincidentally, which I think it could, like, impact other people, like, that's even more magical, right? And that's really great. And so I don't, like, I think people looking to, like, managers to, like, do this stuff are, like, they're missing an opportunity, I think. And, like, and if you wait, you're going to be waiting for a long time, particularly in some cases, right?
Yeah.
Just, like, screw that.
Like, yeah, I mean, our brains don't respect the boundaries that are imposed by an organization necessarily. Like, we respond to personal interaction with people, and our brains perceive people as people, right? Like, it doesn't matter what your title is or where you sit in an organizational structure, that thing was imposed on you. So when you're interacting with another person, you have just as much of a ability to, I don't know, impact that situation as they do.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, it's, that's a powerful perspective, I think, and one that, especially for those people who feel like they're stuck in a really frustrating role or something like that, there are still things you can do. You're not powerless.
Yeah, totally.
By any means. In fact, quite the opposite. Yep. Awesome. Well, this has been really good. I do like to ask all of the people who come on this show a couple of questions. The first one is, if you could give every developer 30 seconds worth of advice, what would you tell them?
Jeez, that we haven't covered in 2 hours. Let me think. Just like, forget ownership, man. Like, it's not worth it. You know, it's just like, the more you hold on to the thing that you think is yours, the worst thing you're gonna make. You know, I think like people, like I think not just developers, but all of us, like, have a tendency to really latch on to the thing we're good at and really try to protect it because we think that's the right thing to do. And it's a super reasonable thing to do. Like, it makes a lot of sense, but it's like counterintuitively not the best thing to do. The more, like, and we've talked a lot of this podcast about, like, you know, designers advocating for design with engineers and with product folks. But the same should be true for engineers. Like, you're great at what you do. Like, advocate for why it's great and why other people should know more about it. You know, I mean, like at Etsy, they did lunch and learns every week about sometimes design stuff, but most of the time, very difficult engineering things that they were working on. And designers went. It was like an open place. The email went out to everybody. Be an advocate for your expertise and like share that with other people that are not in your expertise. I think it's like it'll just give you more leeway and appreciation for what you do.
That's good. Yeah, I like to say a lot of the time that, you know, most of the other practices in our organization other than development is at least in a translucent, if not a transparent box, right? So like I can sort of understand what sales does. I can sort of understand what designers are doing. You know, development quite often seems like they're in an opaque box.
Yeah, it's a little black box, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And there's some empowering aspects of that. There's a little bit of mystery to it. You know, there's this perspective that we're always hacking something or we're always, you know, stealing people's passwords or I don't know, whatever people think that developers do. But I think that's an interesting, improper perspective. And it is a powerful thing to bring things out of that box, right?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Because it helps especially developers to communicate more effectively with other people who previously didn't really know what they were doing.
Yep, absolutely.
That's great. I think, so lunch and learns.
Yep.
So good. Do lunch
so
and
good.
So, and the second question, and this can be, you know, even a personal response, but what is one topic or, you know, maybe one question that you wish more people would ask you so you could talk about it?
Ooh. Do I really want that? let's see. I don't really feel that strongly about people asking me the right questions. Because I feel like whatever they're asking me is the right thing.
Sure. Maybe topic though, right?
Like, yes. It's not so much I wish people would ask me questions. I wish that someone would talk about something that I feel nervous about, that I wish someone else would write a blog about or something, which yeah. is this challenge that I'm having now, which is managing managers. It's really interesting, actually, because, you know, when you manage designers, I don't want to say it's easy. It's not easy. But, like, it's easier because there's an artifact, I think, and there are clear moments of achievement where someone, you know, reached beyond themselves and did something they hadn't done before. And you can watch it happen. And like, you're in the room when they lead a meeting about their design work, right? And that you can see them, their demeanor change over time, and they become more confident or whatever, right? Or not be as dismissive of questions or like concerns, right? You can kind of like, you can watch these things happen and coach it and watch the change, right? Like, and then like, it makes it really easy to see what's going on. When you're managing managers, like, talk about a black box. Like, it's really, really, really hard to know what's happening, because the artifact of that is people, first of all. So that's a hard thing to unpack. The second thing is, like, where it's happening are places I'm not. So in a one-on-one, I'm not there, obviously, right? Like, me, it'd be 2-on-1. So it's a one-on-one, and, like, I'm not there to see how that's going, right? And, like, I'm not going to drop in. That's crazy. And it wouldn't be the same, right? Like, it wouldn't be the same. Or in a meeting with their team, or in a critique with their team, right? Like, I am not in those places. But that is where the work's happening that this person is doing, right? And this is where, like, things are going well or not going well. And then you can get general sense for how things are going, right? You can, like, talk to the designers and stuff. But it's still unclear to me how to help managers. Like, I hope I'm doing a good job. I think I'm doing an okay job.
That is a hard problem to solve. And probably one that not many people have experience with.
Right. Okay. I mean, like, I feel like there's a lot of people who have experience, but I don't know that anybody's, like, writing about it.
Like, I couldn't speak to that right now. You know, I have, like, maybe a very limited amount of experience with that, but on a extremely micro scale, you know? Like, we could sit here and talk in hypotheticals and, you know, psychological maxims or whatever, but ultimately the experience is what would drive a writing session.
Right. Well, what's interesting is, like, for sure, and I can speak to this from experience, like, a lot of the job is communication. It's like strong communication, clear communication, good communication. And, like, when you have a designer, and communication is really important for design too, and when you're just hanging around and you hear a designer have a conversation about their work with someone else, like, you can kind of, like, you can be there and, like, hear it and then, like, talk to them about it later. Right? Be like, hey, that seemed frustrating. How'd that go? But you just can't, there's no mechanism for that with managers. And I don't, like, I don't know. This is my plea to anybody out there who knows anything about this. I really...
Maybe it's you. Maybe you need to start writing about it.
Well, I'm going to start probably writing about it in some form or fashion, but it'll be more of my, like, I don't know what's going on writing. Like, it'll be non-authoritative. It'll be more like...
Well, I think that's how the internet was built, wasn't it?
That is probably true.
That's how most blogs are, at least. I'm saying that I know something about this, but really I just experienced it for the first time.
Right. This will be me just, like, putting the crying emoji over and over and over.
And every manager of managers will probably be like, yep, that's exactly
how it feels.
Yeah, he's
that's
right on.
Yeah. This guy knows a lot. This guy knows a lot about how it feels.
He's right. Spot on, as always, Cap. Oh, that's good stuff. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show, Cap.
No, totally. It was great. I'm
certain that the developers who are listening also appreciate it.
I put my email address online, but if anybody, you know, out there has more questions or, like, you know, wants to talk or whatever, let me know. It's just cwatkins@gmail.com.
There you go. And then, of course, we'll include Cap's blog and anything we mentioned in this very long episode of Developer Tea in the show notes.
If you made it this far, Jonathan's going to send you some stickers, I think.
Yeah, so. Sure. Why not? Yeah, if you contact me, I will use some shipping startup to send you a handful of stickers.
Yeah, you use the promo code I made it this far.
I made it this far. Yeah. Just send me the promo code in an email.
That's right. Cool, man. Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Cap. I appreciate
it. Yeah, totally.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode, my interview with Cap Watkins. Again, of course, this was the second part, so if you didn't hear the first part, make sure you jump back and listen to that as well. If you have questions or comments that you would like for me to address on the show, or even if you just want to talk to me directly, you can always email me at developertea@gmail.com. There's also a Slack community that spec.fm has started. We have over 1,000 designers and developers in there, so there's always good conversation going. You can join that Slack community by going to spec.fm/Slack. Of course, that link, along with all the other links from this episode, can be found in the show notes at spec.fm. Thanks so much for listening to today's episode of Developer Tea, and until next time, enjoy your tea.